Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post a Zolt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post a Zamoron at DungeonsMaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week.
Welcome, everybody. This is a special edition of Recounting Encounters. And today, Mark and I have a special guest with us. We have author of Against the Cult of Chaos, Sean Merwin. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And this is the second time Sean has graciously sat down with us and answered some of our questions. So again, we certainly appreciate that. And I guess we'll just dive right in. Mark, what questions do you have for Sean tonight?
I have a couple of questions. And you play Encounters every week, right?
Yes, I have for the last probably four seasons.
Okay. Do you DM or do you play?
I've DM'd.
Okay.
I guess if you wrote the adventure, it's kind of a cheat to play, right? Because you sort of know what's coming.
Yeah. Well, I would have to drive an hour when Encounters first started. The closest store was an hour away, and so I took my daughter to the first session of the first season, and we played and it was fun, but it was just too much. So finally, which season was it? Oh, it was
Caves of Chaos.
No, it was the cast.
Neverwinter.
Nope. Go back a couple.
The Phantom Brigade.
A gaming store opened just in the town I live in, and that it was just when that season was getting ready to start. So I emailed the guy and said, you know, are you running this? He said, yes, I'm going to. I don't have anyone to DM, though. And I said, well, I can if you need me to. So I DM'd that season and then the following season, the Evard's season. And then the store closed after that.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, and then with the season that I wrote, store opened maybe 30 minutes away. So I emailed that guy and said, you know, I'm involved in this. And he's, yes, I'm looking for someone to run it. So I went and started running it there. So that's been my experience so far. I played at least one encounter of every season somewhere. But for the first, you know, four or five seasons, it was just maybe one or two because I couldn't spend the hour driving on a weeknight.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yep.
Well, long and short, I've been curious. You've done two seasons of Encounters so far, Sean, and they've been both fantastic seasons of Encounters. Number one, are you doing any further seasons of Encounters? And if so, can you tell us what's going on? And if not, what can we expect from you in the future? Because obviously with seasons like this of Encounter, such a great author, great ideas, great everything, I'm sure Wizards still has you under some sort of contract or something to continue with them.
Yeah, they own my soul.
They own mine too, but they don't know it.
Well, I am not working on any upcoming Encounter seasons that I'm aware of. I know that they have to start them several months ahead of time. So I know that at least for the next four or five seasons, I won't be involved. And in fact, I'm looking forward to hopefully playing the upcoming season because I wasn't involved in playtesting or anything. I specifically did not playtest the next season so I could play it with a fresh set of eyes. In terms of what I've been working on, some D&D Next stuff for Wizards, but I really can't talk about it. It's Gen Con related, and so everything's hush-hush until Gen Con gets here.
Excellent.
Yeah. Now I'm looking forward to Gen Con even more.
Well, yes.
That's what I was saying. You're going to be at Gen Con, so we'll have an opportunity to actually meet you face-to-face, which is hopefully we can at this point.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be easy to find. We'll be the two nerdiest guys running up going, we love your work. You're awesome.
Well, you will be the only two saying that, so that will be
we'll be wearing our Canadian hats, our big Canadian hats like we did for Fourth Core last year.
Excellent. Well, you know, if you're the geekiest guys at Gen Con, then you've got some work cut out for you.
Nice. So, what actually, speaking of Gen Con, what's your actual participation in Gen Con? I mean, I know that you're talking about NDA, you're working on D&D Next stuff, et cetera, but are you basically going to be DMing? Are you going to be talking on panels? Do you know any of that stuff yet?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but my general modus operandi is DMing for Bald Man Games, which is the company that handles all of Wizards organized play and other convention games. So usually they sublet my soul for the week. I usually try to run at least 16 hours worth of games. So if it's a 4-hour game, you know, about four games, and then spend the rest of the time, you know, playing or going to the dealer room or having meetings or doing whatever else needs to be done while I'm there.
Very cool.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to change gears then for a minute because I got a few questions. So, Sean, one of the things that a lot of people, including me, really liked about this season is that it draws heavy influence from some of the classic adventures. I'm just wondering, first of all, What is your personal experience with these classics? The Village of Hamlet, Temple of Elemental Evil, Keep on Borderlands, Against the Cult of the Reptile God. Were you familiar with those before you started working on this, or were these new to you when you picked this up?
No, I had played all of them at some point in my playing career. I've been playing since the late 70s, so it was I've been around the block once or twice in terms of games, but. Village of Hamlet is one of those adventures where if you've played D&D for a long time, you've probably played it a dozen times or more. When it first came out, it was really one of the first adventures where there was a place where adventurers could live and not just go off into a dungeon that actually had some adventuring in it. So when people would start a new campaign and they didn't have time to make a city or a new place where the adventurers could be from, they would just pull out Hamlet. And so I've probably had that adventure open more than any other adventure in terms of my playing or DMing or creating my own campaigns. So it was almost second nature to me. I know, you know, all of the NPCs' names and where they're found and all the little quests that go along with it.
So how much, let me just jump in quickly then. So how much of what we saw in this season of Encounters as far as the little side adventures came directly from your personal gaming experiences, like at your gaming table?
Not a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did much more trying to, since it was such an amalgam of those essentially three adventures, there wasn't a lot that I can remember unless I snuck it in subconsciously that actually happened at any games that I've run in the past. It's been years since I've had much to do with Against the Cult of the Reptile God or Village of Hamlet. Against the Cult of the Reptile God, I remember distinctly because it was the first time as a player that my party got TPK'd. You know, it was a total party kill. We did very badly in that adventure. And so that's why that one stuck out so well when I received this assignment, because it was such a brutal experience when I played.
Well, it was brutal for one of the ones where we played it. I remember one of my tables got TPK'd this time around when they had to face the reptile god. It was ugly. Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Don't get me wrong. I had a blast. But yeah, our group got just destroyed.
So did mine. And if you listen to the podcast, basically I let a dead character bring a leader back in last minute to save. I don't know. He jumped through one of the holes from the surface or something.
Yeah, as I was running that session for the group that I'm running for, I was flashing back to the time that I played it, you know, back in first edition AD&D days when the Naga set off a fireball right in the middle of our ship as we were coming around a little curve. I remember that. I'm going to do that to these guys. Yeah, it wasn't quite that bad, but Nice. I wasn't taking out any repressed hatred of my old DM or anything.
So definitely now, not. Knowing that these classic adventures were, you know, part of the influence, did Wizards provide you with copies of these as sort of a starting point? Like, here, read these. Now we want you to write this new adventure? Or, like, how much direction came from Wizards as far as that?
I had a meeting at last year's Gen Con with James Wyatt, who talked about the campaign that he was currently running at that time, which was an amalgam of those three adventures. And he said, you know, for the next encounter season or the one that we want you to write, I want you to use these three. And he explained what he was doing with his home campaign, you know, which was very similar to how this season turned out. And he said, you know, do you think you could come up with a story, blend these three? He was running a campaign that was using the Rod of Seven Parts.
Okay.
And so we didn't want to go in that direction because that's, you know, if you run a Rod of Seven Parts campaign, that's a long campaign. So we left that part out, but he, you know, wanted to still blend in these three adventures. And so when I was thinking of a backstory for it, you know, what's the big threat behind everything? The story of Miska, the wolf spider, came from that Rod of Seven Parts adventure. So I just used that kind of mythology and that background, you know, as the impetus behind what was happening in the encounter season itself. But the rest of it was just sitting down, reading over the old adventures again and thinking, okay, we're going to combine all three of these things. Each one had its own threat. How can we tie all those threats together but still have an adventure where people can go in different directions and not have a kind of, you know, a systematic railroad that they have to follow to get the whole story.
Now, speaking of the story itself, I found it very interesting, the meld of all three separate distinct adventures. Now, this is probably the least linear season in D&D Encounters. It boggles my mind how you can tie all that together. Now, there's a lot of information that you threw at us and a lot of adventure hooks. So I guess my question is how did you manage to keep all that straight?
I hope I did. I don't know if I did. Well, what I kind of vacillated back and forth on how tight to make the story, because, as you said, this was the first time where Wizards said, for this season, we want the DMs to be able to run the encounters in any order. And at first I panicked because I thought, this is, you know, encounters is sit down, run this one encounter. When you start allowing it to go in any direction it wants, there's all these problems that are going to come from that, including what if you have 18 players who are all switching tables from session to session, and they're playing encounters in different orders. What are you going to do? And so that's why when I sat down to write it, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to make, even though there is a big threat behind the story, I'm going to have to make it loose so it doesn't have to be played in kind of a wheels within wheels sort of system where, you know, you solve one mystery which leads to a bigger mystery. In this case, there just has to be three separate mysteries, and you know, the story can be told going in any different direction from that. So I wrote the adventure with that in mind, and I also had to kind of let go and say to myself, you're going to have to trust the DMs this season to be able to pull everything together and go off on their own little tangent if they have to. And that's hard to do, you know, as a writer, as a game designer. It's hard to think that you're going to be letting someone, you know, it's kind of like when you write a novel or something and you just have to let it go and you can't listen to what people do with it once it's gone. And it's gone, they're going to do with it what they're going to do with it. As a game designer, in this case, I had to do that. I had to say, go ahead, play it. If you change the story, great. I hope I left enough hooks in there where people could take a hook and go with it in a different direction if they needed to.
And we did. If,
yeah, we certainly did.
And that's great.
Yeah, no, I got to say, this, I mean, we said the same thing last season, but this season so far has been my favorite, largely because we didn't have the railroad. You could go in any order and you could make it your own. I mean, there were certainly some challenges we faced, and if I had a chance to run it again, I think I could do some of the things better, and I might have done some of the things a little differently as the DM, but I love that it was exactly to your point. There was the framework in place. I knew I had to do certain things when they were taking on certain encounters, but there was still so much room for the party to do whatever. And the fact that I'm playing it at two different stores, I'm running it at one store and playing it at another store. Like, I was amazed when some weeks we did the same encounter at both stores, and it was so radically different based on the decisions the party made. It wasn't just, no matter what you do, you still have to go through the door and fight the monster and get on the boat. It's like, you know, whatever it happened to be that week, it was very different in most cases. And in almost every case, it was a ton of fun.
Well, I mean, the reptile god itself, I mean, to give you an example also, is I did the reptile god section backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to Derek's point, is I went and played in Toronto one day, and it was totally different than the way we ran it. And it was just, it's amazing what you can do with this season. And that's the one thing that really got me.
Yeah, it's you know, it's interesting to hear people say that, because back in AD&D times, you know, there were no, let's just say, there weren't the plethora of adventures that you could find pre-made. So, you know, anything that you did, you were off the rails. You know, even if you had even if you bought Tomb of Horrors or the Slave Pit series, You still had to put them in a context of your own. So even if you used those published adventures, you were creating the rest of the world on your own. And you, for people who have only played 4th edition, you know, they tend to get into this pattern of, if it's not on the page, I can't do it. So it was nerve-wracking, but it was freeing to show people, you can do this. You can take what's written, go in different directions. You know where you have to end, but how you get there is your own choice. In the game I was running, they came back from the top part of the moat house after dealing with the bandits, and they were going to question the merchants to get the password. And of course, they come back to the village, and they divide not into a group of two, but they divide into four different groups. One person by himself went to the Golden Grain Inn. Two people went to the merchants. Two people went to the church. And a couple people went off to talk to the Windell, the halfling.
You mean he didn't die in the first week?
No, he didn't. He survived. So here I am sitting here going, first of all, not only are you breaking the first rule of D&D, don't split up, but you're dividing into four separate groups, and three of those groups are going into places where people might be attacked. Oh, you know what? The fourth group went to talk to the...
Temple Library?
The constable, oh. who was also not a good guy. So I could have had all four groups basically get attacked. One went to the temple where there's evil. One went to the merchants where there's evil. One went to the... And I'm thinking, I could just run four separate encounters. I could kill all these, you know, group, this single person, this group of two, this group of two, this group of two. And so instead, I just had the guy who went to the Golden Grain Inn get attacked. But everybody else knew that. So they came back together and went to the Golden Grain Inn. So I was expecting to run the second half of the Moat House when I ended up having to run the Golden Grain Inn encounter because one guy got waylaid there.
Yeah. No, our group did the same, similar. We did the Moat House, the top of the Moat House in the first week. And then we didn't do the bottom half of the Moat House until this week, week 7, which, yep. If you had asked me at the beginning, where do you think they're going to go? I would never have guessed that they would have split the Moat House up from week 2 to week 7. Like, it just, in retrospect, it makes perfect sense the way they played it out, just like you explained. They went to somewhere they weren't supposed to, or they went somewhere where there was danger, and you know, one thing led to another, and suddenly they're on a whole other side quest.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with us. So it's just kind of, it's fun, and it lets the players, you know, as we've been saying, lets the players make their own path, but it also lets the DM, you know, think about how the game should run and what consequences should be. And depending on the players, the consequences might be good. The consequences might, you know, be ill for the players, but you know, the DM can do a little more than just be the judge that points to the stat blocks in the adventure and roll some dice.
No, you were, back to the point. I really like what you said, is that the non-linear approach, I don't know if I can hypothesize about this, but is this Wizards kind of telling all those 4th edition players, the hardcore 4th edition players, you said that 4th edition, it's more like if it's not in front of their face, they have trouble, that they're not used to that open-ended, think on the top of your, you know, from top of your head, you know, whatever. Is this Wizards' way of saying, hey, you know what, 5th is coming out, or D&D Next is coming out, you know, this is how technically D&D should be run. We're trying to get away from the 4th edition mentality.
Yeah, I don't know if they had that specific lesson in mind, if they were trying to teach the 4th edition player something. But there was definitely the feeling that they're, you know, adventures like the Village of Hamlet were different than some of the things that we've been seeing for 4th edition. So, hey players, hey DMs, here's something. It's going to be a little different way of playing. See how you like it. See how it works. And like I said, I was worried because I love those kinds of adventures, but I didn't know if Encounters was going to be the best place, you know, to bring that kind of play to light. And so far, it's sounding pretty good. It sounds like many of the DMs, either because they've played before and realized, you know, how it works, or because they are just grasped it and ran with it, have been able to pull it off.
It was tough. Believe me, it was tough. For myself, it was tough as a DM. But I'm just glad that somebody else didn't have to pick up after me once in a while, because that would have been, they'd have to read the whole thing, right?
Right.
But
that was one of the things. I mean, we got a lot of praise for this, but obviously we do have some feedback, and that was one of the only bad things we said was, previously in the encounter system, you could have someone show up the day of the adventure, and then the store owner could say, "We need another table. Who wants to be the DM? Here's a copy of the adventure. Take 15 minutes to read it up," and they could run it, even if it was a relatively inexperienced DM. But there is absolutely no way you could do that this time around and do a good job of it.
Right.
Which I mean, that's just the nature of a nonlinear story. But, you know, so to your point of, will it work for encounters, for the groups that are there every week, I think it worked amazing. Mm-hmm. But in those, you know, what I hope would be rare circumstances where someone came in and had to run it cold, I'm glad that never happened to me as the player or the DM.
Oh, I completely agree. At the store where I was running it, we usually have two tables. So the other DM and I, we sat down and, you know, she read through parts of it and she said, "How are we going to do this?" And I said, "Why don't we just do, we'll follow the path. We'll follow the path that the adventure sets." And so we said, okay. And then halfway through the season, she had a couple of family emergencies. So I was running tables of 8, 9, 10 players. So it was tough, but we didn't have that disconnect then. You know, there wasn't her table running something different than what I was running. So it ended up working out, even though she was gone. No one else had to step up, but we didn't have any new players come in to, you know, who would be thrown off by the randomness of the encounters of the sessions.
Yeah, we were fortunate at the two stores where I play. We although the tables every week seemed to be doing different encounters, we only had a couple of situations where people had to jump from one table to the other. I don't think anybody repeated a session. The players that we usually you know, sort of said, hey, would you mind going over to that table? It was always someone who had already missed a couple of sessions. Mm-hmm. And so no, as far as I know, nobody ended up playing the same session twice at either store, even though a couple of people played from table to table. It worked out okay. But, I mean, obviously that's a risk as well, is if you go from three tables to four tables or then back again, you could potentially have, hey, this is the third time I've played the Caves of Chaos. What's going on? How chaotic are these caves?
Yeah, they are very chaotic.
Yes.
No, I thought about that a lot while I was designing the adventure, and I suggested that we would put in two extra encounters. That if, in case you have a lot of players who've already played this, you know, run this encounter instead, and then you could, you know, if you needed to, you could stick the Scroll of Final Words here, or you could, you know, do tie up this story, but just tie it up in this place instead of that place. But they said we don't really have the room for that. So that's why in the text I just threw in a couple places. If you do need to run an extra encounter, you know, put one at the inn of the Winsome Wench, I think is what they ended up calling it. Or, you know, run a full encounter with the traders in town.
Yeah, so, I really wanted to run that, but time just, it didn't happen at either of my groups. But one to me seemed like it could have been a full-blown week on its own.
Oh, yeah, it definitely could have. And I also, one of the things I tried to do is always end an encounter in town. So if there was a switch up of tables, at least the person wouldn't be magically transported from the caves back to town. You know, the adventures always began and ended in town. Or should have.
Should have.
I want to ask you about the, we'll call it a pseudo skill challenge. The escape from the Reptile God Caverns.
Right.
Now, in this adventure, we didn't have any fourth edition by the book rules as written skill challenges. But this mm-hmm. section, this part, in my mind, really, that's what it was. I'm just wondering whose decision was it, or what sort of direction or feedback did you get around making it or not making it an actual X number of successes before failure skill challenge?
I didn't get any directives about skill challenges from Wizards directly. But in my own fourth edition writing, I've pretty much scrapped skill challenges, not because I don't like them, because I actually really do like them, but I scrapped them because so much misinformation has been interpreted, I guess, by DMs, because I think Wizards originally dropped the ball on skill challenges by trying to make them like combat. You know, at one point, it might have been in the first DMG, it said roll initiative and in order players must do this and that, and which is just the opposite of what skill challenges actually are and should be. As far as I'm concerned, players should never even know they're in a skill challenge. All a skill challenge does is it takes something that DMs have been doing since 1974. Which is put characters into non-combat situations and see what they do. And sometimes roles are involved and sometimes they're not. But a good DM will set up a situation where the players are doing something, and in the DM's mind, he knows that in order to succeed, they need to do this. It may be a role, or it may not be a role. It may be saying the right thing to the right person. It may be, you know, coming up with a different approach to an old problem. But to me, a skill challenge is a way of putting a structure around something that up until that point, DMs had to create their own structures for. And it was a suggestion to DMs, this is a cool way to play the game in a slightly different way. And when DMs, again, you know, if it's in the book, that's what they follow to the letter. When they started doing that, it just sucked all the fun out of what a skill challenge should and could be. So that's why in this case, where I threw in the little skills afterwards, I thought that that session would be too short. if there wasn't a little something to do. So I just thought, okay, I'll throw in some suggestions for what could happen as the as the PCs are trying to lead these scared, tired, exhausted, innocent people out of this collapsing series of caverns and tunnels. And if the DMs weren't up to it, I would rather just have them skip it completely. But if they could see how they could make the moment dramatic, then here's a little structure that you can use. Here's a couple of scenes you can use to show that, yes, you beat this threat, but here's this other threat that you can't beat with swords and spells. How are you going to handle that?
Yeah, no, it's when I played it, I had a lot of fun playing it. When I ran it as the DM, unfortunately, the store where we play, we have a hard end date because the store closes, or an ending time. So we only had like 5 minutes left. So I apologized to the group and just sort of walked them through, okay, this is what, I made it more of a narration than a role play, which I sort of regret doing, but given the time constraints, that was my only option. But no, I absolutely agree with what you said. Like, I think it was certainly a nice add-on if you had time. And from what I heard from the groups that did play it and run it, they seemed to enjoy it. So Craig or Mark, what did you do with that with your group? Did you even run that part?
I ended up doing the same thing. They basically killed those skills, right? I tried to play it a little bit like Sean mentioned, like non-combat situation. I kind of went, okay, you're making your way back to the surface. You see these rocks. It looks like it was a cave in, but it almost looks like it was placed there. And then, one guy went up and says, well, I do a perception check. Well, you don't hear anything, that kind of thing. And it was a lot of fun. It ended up flooding the tunnel, but they managed to do, a lot of them say, well, can I do an acrobatics check to hang on to some of the prisoners? Yeah, sure, go ahead. But two of them miss it. Right? You just do that kind of thing, and they went down a sinkhole. And then the shard mine right away. I don't have to breathe, so I'm just going to go in there and get them. It was really a lot of fun, and the players had a lot of fun with that, too.
Yeah, it works well if the players are the ones that are talking during the skill challenge and not the DM. If the DM is talking during the skill challenge, then it's not a good skill challenge, either as written or as run. If the players are saying, okay, I need to solve this problem, here's how I'm going to do it, then at least you've got a good start in that direction.
Yeah, with my group, we had quite a few new players. I seemed to be the table that whenever we had new players walk into the store, they got sent to my table, which I have no problem with. I like playing with new players. Like, that's a big part of why I DM encounters. But it was, in a way, I was kind of glad that we didn't do it, because I suspected that some of the newer players who were sort of shy would have really not understood what was going on, and may not have felt that they got to participate as much as they wanted to. So,
yeah. Well, at that session, I had a table of six. The other DM couldn't show up that day. So I had six players. I was like, perfect. Six players, a couple guys didn't show. We can run a normal session. And then a guy, middle-aged guy and his 8-year-old son come in. He got the red box in his hands going, are you guys playing D&D? Come on in, sit down. And of course, we're playing we're playing next.
Oh, jeez.
So I whipped out a couple of pre-gens and gave gave the boy a fighter, gave the guy a wizard. Said, here's the situation. We're in between the rule sets right now. We're using this new rule set. Everything's on the character sheet you need. And the kid who was kind of quiet at first, when we had the fight with the Naga, and they're on the boat, and I explained the situation to him. I said, okay, you're over here, and there's this water between you and your boat and the land, but there's this big monster there. And he was playing the dwarf, I think, fighter or dwarf barbarian or something. He's got a great axe. I said, you've got this huge axe, and they're trying to get the boat to the shore, but they keep failing their strength checks to push the boat. And so they're trying to tell the kid, you need to push the boat closer. And he says, I jump and swing my axe at the end. I'm like, okay. So, he's ignoring everybody. This kid's just loving life.
Good
so
for
he
him.
He leaps, and he hits the Naga with his axe. So, by the end, when we're doing this kind of the skill challenge thing, so I'm going around the table and, what are you doing? And this is what's happening. What are you doing? And the kid's like, I'm strong, right? And I said, yes, you are. It was, I pick somebody up and throw them over my shoulder. I was like, you all right, roll that die and add your strength. And, you know, he was getting right into it. So it was really cool.
Speaking of D&D Next, how did that go for you?
The jury's still out. well, it's the store I'm running at, it's really kind of strange because most of the players are young kids. I think we talked about this last time. Most of the players are kind of young kids who have never really played D&D. Last season when we played the fourth edition, there was their first experience with D&D. So they've only just gotten a taste of fourth edition, and then enough of the players wanted to try Next that we've moved to Next. So it's still in their early stages of learning the game. So there's still kind of confusing rules between fourth and Next and, you know, Magic and whatever else they've played in the past. But it's really tough because, you know, fourth edition is great for this kind of encounter, rest. And you know when to use your resources, and you've kind of got this flow to everything. Where Next is better when it breaks that, and you kind of get, there's a different rhythm, I think, to a game when you use Next, because it doesn't have that same encounter, and your resources are kind of managed almost, you know, by default based on those encounters. And so trying to play Next in that encounter rhythm, just it's awkward still. So I'm still fighting that fourth edition mindset of both myself as the DM and of the players, you know, to think of things as encounters rather than thinking of things in a more organic, story-driven driven game rather than an encounter-driven game.
Right.
So I feel weird running it, but the players don't seem to have that same problem, because when I mentioned, you know, next season's coming up, we're going to have a choice again if we want to do fourth edition or if we want to do Next, and almost to a person, they want to do Next again. So I guess it's going well enough that they're happy.
What I found with the two stores where I play is it's that familiarity and the financial commitment and the time commitment that's already gone into fourth edition. People are a lot more reluctant to try a system that they know is not yet perfect, especially when they've got a bookshelf full of books. They've got a DDI subscription with the character builder. They've got, you know, potentially 3, 4, 5 years in with the fourth edition mindset. It's hard. And I mean, that's sort of the boat I'm in, is it's hard to turn your back on that experience and those materials and the financial commitment and all that to say, okay, let's throw all that away and let's come to it new with this new edition that may still have some bugs, but until we play it, we don't know what those bugs are. So it's been a tough sell. Like for our group, we've had, I think, two people that were very hardcore about wanting to do it, and everyone else was just sort of like, nah, let's just keep going with fourth edition.
Now, these people that want to continue on fourth edition, though, Derek, do they play on a regular basis, like with a group aside?
Some do. It's about an even split. Some do, some don't. I mean, I know me. I play 3, 4 times a week sometimes, and one of my groups is saying, no, we're done. Fourth edition, over. And the other groups are like, we can't get enough fourth edition. Like, just pile it on. So I think it really comes down to the individuals.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely a matter of if you like that, the structure that fourth edition brings to the game. Some people cannot get enough of it because it's, like I said, it's a very natural, I think, rhythm for a game of that encounter rest. And some people just bristle against that, you know, that structure that's pre-made almost in the game. A lot of the adults who are playing at the store I'm running, you know, are all old school gamers. They've played fourth edition, but they preferred that old school feel that they're getting with Next. And the younger kids who are playing, they don't care what they play as long as they're playing something.
That's a good point.
So they're like, okay, yeah, as long as I have an axe and can hit something or, you know, shoot an arrow into something, sign me up. So
the conversion kit is available online, is it not?
It's available with the packet, with the D&D Next packet.
Oh, so the playtest packet, it comes with that.
Yep, it comes right with it. And I assume that the same thing will happen with the next season.
I picked up the new season this evening. It had a one-page guide sheet, but the conversion kit is now available for download. I know I downloaded it earlier this week.
Okay.
So it's a combination of the bits and pieces. I mean, the materials are there if you want to run the D&D Next, and I'm sure if you can't find them, and a quick email to Wizards of the Coast will settle that out.
Okay. Because, like I said, I have had nothing to do with the next season. I'm specifically not looking so I can have some surprises. So you know better than I on that point.
Now, how did you find it as a DM? Like, I mean, okay, you're the co-author of this season of Encounters. How did you find it running it as a DM? Were you still surprised?
I it's always surprising to run a game, especially for strangers, even if you wrote it, because the way I run games, the players tell more of the story than the DM or the whatever's written. You know, if the player asks, is there something weird about that statue, then there's going to be something weird about that statue, whether the adventure says so or not. You know, that's all part of the game. It's their imagination is telling the story at least as much as the DMs or the writers. It has to. That's what's cool about the game. That's what's driven the game for the last 40 years. Is everyone's imagination. And so I'm always surprised to hear the plans that the players come up with, and then figuring out on the fly, okay, this plan is going to work. How is it going to work? How am I going to, you know, or it's an okay plan, but here are the flaws with it. So these are the obstacles I'm going to throw at them to get the plan to work. Cool. So yeah, I'm always surprised, you know, like with the party splitting up into a group of four different little singles and duos going off into dens of iniquity and or evil. And how am I going to handle that?
Sounds good.
Now, I guess we could talk about the last session, because this is kind of like the prequel, the almost the finale is coming up. So, do you have any tips? I'm trying to hesitate to say that. What's the word I'm looking for? Any
advice, maybe, for, I don't know. We talked about this in our weekly podcast. Like, I haven't read The Last Encounter yet. I'm trying to keep it a surprise because I play it before I run it.
Right.
But I know that we're going to get people listening to this podcast that are DMs that maybe want a little something. Like, do you have any tidbits you can suggest without giving anything significant away? Because we know a lot of players listen to this too. Mm-hmm. That you know, maybe the DMs could get ready for, or that you might advise them. Like, by the way, you may want to go back and reread this before you continue on. Or
I will say this for final encounters in the adventures that I write, I like them to have a lot of things going on. If you played the end of the last season, there may have been a little too much going on. So always be thinking about one more wrinkle you can add to the encounter. There's going to be three or four wrinkles about different things that PCs have to do or can try or need to do in order to defeat this horribly chaotic but, you know, very powerful being, and the parasites that have been feeding off of its power. So think about their motivations and what they've been doing this for a while now. What are these evil guys planning to do when they know that there's always some good goody out there who's going to come and try to foil their plans? and try to figure out how to bring half Ron.
Oh, the ghost, Halfrin Hommel.
Yep, bring him into it. He's already involved, kind of. So you know, think I tried to add in his story to the ending, not just as part of a story, but also mechanically. So you know, I'm sure a good DM will be able to look at that and say, okay, I have a better way of bringing this in, or a better ending to this story than that.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Very, very, very good.
Cool. Okay, well, I think that's about everything I can think of. Mark, you got any other questions for Sean?
No, he answered all my questions, and it was amazing.
Well, thank you guys for your podcast, because there's nothing cooler than listening to, you know, how people are playing through your adventure. So I get a huge kick out of it. Listen every week.
Well, we thank you.
Yeah, really. Tell all your friends.
All three of them know.
So, Sean, is there anything that we can do for you? Are there anything you want to plug? Do you want to let people know maybe how they can follow you on Twitter or anything like that?
At Twitter, I am at Sean Merwin. If you make it to Gen Con this year, come to the Wizards area, wherever that may be, and you know, sign up to run some games. And if you see me there, stop me, say hi, grab a drink, grab lunch, whatever. I'd love to talk gaming with anybody.
Well, we'll definitely see you at Gen Con this year.
Yeah, sounds I think we'll good. Take you up on that offer for sure.
I will look for the two geekiest Canadians there.
An ale of destiny for all of us.
Sounds good.
Okay, well, again, thanks, Sean, and maybe we can get you on down the road for next season when you've been just the player and get your feedback as a guest contributor to our weekly Recounting Encounters.
Sounds good.
Excellent. You can follow me on Twitter at Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit dungeonsmaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot, and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D encounters. That's 20footradius20ftradius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.